Blog Talk Radio.
The reason politicians try so hard to get reelected is that they would hate to have to try to make a living under the laws they've passed.
You're listening to the Goldstein on Geld Show with financial expert Douglas Goldstein. This show is designed to give general information related to investing and finance. Neither Doug Goldstein, his guests, nor the radio station are rendering legal, tax, insurance, or specific financial advice. If you require such advice, contact a competent professional advisor. Before making any investment decisions based on what you heard during the show, please review the complete disclaimer located at www.goldsteinongeld.com. And now, here's your host, Money Maven Doug Goldstein.
Good Money Monday. I'm Doug Goldstein. Thanks so much for joining me. We've got a fantastic show today. In fact, my first guest is a lawyer, a fellow named David Lesperance, who came to me because he heard the interview that I did with Roger Ver a few weeks back. Now, Roger is often called the Bitcoin Jesus because he made millions of dollars in dealing in the Bitcoin world, but that's not why I brought him on. I brought him on because he gave up his U.S. citizenship and had a huge amount of trouble with it. So I'm bringing on this lawyer who contacted me. He said, you know, Doug, it wasn't exactly accurate, everything that was on the show that you heard from Roger Ver. Now, Roger was not an expert on the technicalities of expatriation, but David Lesperance apparently is. In fact, he's been named by the Wall Street Journal as probably the top lawyer in the business of advising wealthy U.S. citizens on how to expatriate to lower tax countries. So I'm very, very excited to have him on to hear some of the details. Obviously, we are not recommending one way or the other, but a lot of the listeners to the Goldstein on Geld show are people who live outside the United States or have spent some time outside the United States, and they're trying to decide whether they should give up their U.S. citizenship. It's a major decision for a lot of people, and I think we need to learn a lot more about it. So I'm looking forward to having him on the show. And then in the second half of the show, I'll be bringing on Laura Adams. Laura is a personal finance expert. She has been featured on Fox News and NBC News and USA Today, and she'll be talking about some money-making ideas that she deals with. Stay tuned in just a minute. I want to talk to you about a very, very interesting conversation I had this week in my office. Now let's hear from CPA Ron Zalbin with a tax tip on the Goldstein on Geld show.
Hi, I'm Ron Zalbin, a U.S. and Israeli CPA with the accounting firm of Abulafi Avital and Sharansky with offices in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. As a continuation of a previous segment, I'd like to talk to you about capital gains and capital losses in the United States. There is a special set of rules called the wash sale rules, where when you sell stock at a loss, that loss is disallowed. So now let's get into the particulars of that disallowed loss. A wash sale happens when you sell or dispose of securities or stock at a loss, and within 30 days before or after the sale, you buy the same stock or securities, or you enter into a contract or option to acquire substantially the same stock or securities, or you acquire substantially identical stock or securities through your IRA or your Roth IRA account. So let's say you sold them in a taxable account and then you acquire them in a IRA or Roth IRA account, that loss is not deductible. Now, this only pertains to losses. For example, if you had 100 shares of Caterpillar stock, which you sold on January 1st for a gain and then buy back the same amount of shares of Caterpillar stock on January 2nd, there is no problem with that. You can recognize the gain. However, if you sold the stock on January 1st at a loss and buy the same stock back on January 2nd, that is not deductible loss. What happens is the loss is actually added back to the cost of that new stock that you bought on January 2nd. Very often, the wash sale rules will apply to mutual funds because there are dividend reinvestments. Those dividend reinvestments are considered purchase of new stock. Your financial institution should keep track of when wash sales occur, and it should be reflected on your 1099 that you receive at the end of the year. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to email me at ron@abulafia.co.il.
Thanks so much, CPA Ron Zalbin, for today's Goldstein on Geld Tax Tip. A woman came into my office this week. She had inherited a portfolio from her mother that was filled with mutual funds. And she sat down. She goes, okay, let's look through each fund. so I said, you know, instead of looking through each fund, let's take a step back and look at the big picture. And she said, no, I just want to know, is this fund good? Is that fund good? Should I sell this? Should I buy that? And I said, hold on a second. You're way, way ahead of yourself. And here's why. People in different stages in life have different needs about how they invest. And obviously her mother, who had been living on her portfolio in her 80s and 90s, was in a different situation from this woman in terms of investment needs. Not only that, the mother had a very different tolerance for risk, different goals, lived in a different country, and there were so many differences that there was no point in starting off by looking at each individual piece. Instead, what we needed to do was to back up and try and figure out what was the purpose now for the client today of this portfolio. Did she need to look for more growth? Did she need to start getting income from the portfolio? What were her feelings about the level of risk? What was she going to be comfortable with? So that led into a whole long discussion, forgetting the investments individually. We started really by talking about how much the client earns and how much she spends. What are her family obligations? What does she need to do for her kids? And where does she want to live? What are her retirement goals? Travel, vacation, health, all of these topics. So we spent a long time talking about that. That's really the big picture. After we had spoken about that, then it was so much easier to go through the portfolio because right away we were able to figure out which funds she didn't want to hold because they didn't fit into her plan. So those were easy just to sell off. And then we had to look at some of the specifics. But you have to do it in that order so that you can make smart decisions about what's right for you, not what was right for your mother. So when you inherit a portfolio, make sure that you start from scratch. Don't assume that you have to keep everything, because in most cases that I've seen, when people inherit portfolios, they're filled with assets that can easily be sold. And sometimes that's just the right thing you need to do. All right, stay tuned. Just a minute, I'll be bringing on my first guest, lawyer David Lesbrands, to talk to us about giving up your U.S. citizenship.
Learn to manage your money with investment advisor Doug Goldstein. Doug is the author of Building Wealth in Israel. He's an international financial planner and the host of the Goldstein on Gelt show.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt show David Lesbrands, who's a specialist in international law. In fact, the Wall Street Journal referred to him as probably the top lawyer in the business of advising wealthy U.S. citizens on how to expatriate to lower tax countries. David, real pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Doug.
So before we go into the details of expatriation, just give me a summary of what are the tax obligations that U.S. citizens have when they live outside the U.S.
The United States is unique in having citizenship-based taxation. So an American living abroad, for example, in Israel, has the exact same tax obligations that they would have if they lived in Brooklyn. What they may have is an opportunity to offset with foreign earned income or foreign tax credits that the person in Brooklyn would not have.
Okay, so if a person decides to move to Israel, he's still going to have to file his tax return. He's going to have to pay tax to the United States. He may get a credit for the tax that he paid in the U.S. Are there any other special tax forms he should be aware of?
Yes, he will actually get tax credit for the tax that he pays in Israel on his U.S. So in that particular case, both Israel and the United States would be interested in tax from him. You look through the tax treaty, see who gets the check and who gets the foreign tax credit, and he would file appropriately. He may be filing simply a 1040 NR for non-resident, or depending on how complex his life is, he may be filing other forms. He would certainly have bank accounts outside of the United States, so he would be filing what are called FBARs, or foreign bank account reports.
And if he neglects to file a FBAR, when I talk about this topic on the show, I always tell people it's terrible, terrible if you don't do it, but maybe you can scare people a little bit more to let them know really what does happen if you don't properly file an FBAR, and you should.
Well, the problem with an FBAR is that it sneaks up on you. It is only $10,000 per year, and most people don't realize that that's the amount total flowing in and out. So even that account that you have for your child who's off at university, who you pay tuition, monthly expenses, if that comes up to over $10,000 in a year, you need to file that. If you don't, you are subject to massive penalties and interest, and they look at the high watermark of that. And you could quite easily find that you will pay much more in tax and penalties than you would that the account would have for the account's total itself.
So let me clarify. When you said the cash that flows through the account, if you put $2,000 a month into the account and while your kid is studying at Hebrew University and he spends that money, so at the end of the month there's zero, but you're saying that over the course of 12 months, if you have altogether put in $24,000, that becomes reportable on your FBAR?
Correct.
Wow. Wow, interesting. And the penalties are very high. And also just to clarify, when a U.S. person leaves the United States and he goes and opens a brokerage account and the broker says, well, are you going to sign a W-8 saying that you're not a U.S. person or a W-9, what would the U.S. citizen who now lives overseas have to sign?
Well, unless if they are still a U.S. citizen, they're going to have to sign the W-8.
Sorry, let's say they retain their U.S. citizenship. They make aliyah, right? They just moved to Israel,
yes.
But now they're dual citizens. What would they sign then?
They would sign the form that would indicate that they are still a U.S. citizen and would pay. The brokerage firm in Israel would report, withhold, and remit on the income that was generated by that account.
Okay, so now let's go a little bit further into this guy's case. Someone's listening to the show. He says, wow, David Letzbrandt tells me that I'm going to have to keep paying taxes if I remain a U.S. citizen, but I'm pretty much done with the U.S. I've moved to Israel. I've been here 10, 15, 20 years, not interested in having these obligations anymore. What if I just mail in my passport and say goodbye and good riddance? What happens then?
Well, the decision to expatriate, well, that is a major part of my law practice. It is not really the first thing that people should focus on. One thing that there are a number of people who have been out of compliance who either didn't realize that they had to file these U.S. forms or didn't even realize that they were Americans. Expatriation is not going to help them. It doesn't clean up past sins. It only helps you to move forward. So the first thing is that you need to make things right with the U.S. government and bring all your taxes up to date for the last 5 years with the U.S. government. You then make a decision. You say, moving forward, I'm either going to remain a U.S. citizen with the benefits that then there are, a significant number of benefits to being an American, and I will do all the compliance, the FBARs, the dual filings, et cetera, that I need to in order to stay IRS compliant. If you decide that the benefits don't outweigh the costs and hassles, which an increasing number of people are doing, then you have to take steps to formally renounce your U.S. citizenship. It is not a process of mailing in your passport. You have to make an appointment with a U.S. embassy or consulate outside of the United States. You have to go through a formal renunciation process. And in due course, the U.S. government will issue you a document called a certificate of loss of nationality, which is the U.S. government's confirmation that you are no longer a U.S. citizen.
We are talking with David Letzbrandt, who specializes in helping mostly, I guess, high net worth people, but people who want to possibly give up their citizenship or not give up their citizenship, but just set up a situation where they have let's say, a more beneficial tax structure in order to make sure that they're not continuing to pay tax on all of the money that they're earning. And of course, he does that for people in a legal way. And a lot of people, unfortunately, do it in an illegal way. David, you mentioned something a minute ago, and I just want to touch on it. You said there are certain benefits to being an American citizen. Now, I love America, and I grew up there, and I have many great things to say. But for someone who's living out, whose main residence now is no longer in the U.S. and only sees it as a destination for occasional vacations, visiting some family, and perhaps shopping. Other than that, is there a real benefit to that person to maintain his citizenship?
Again, individuals decide that for themselves, but you are finding that an increasing number of these dual citizens, particularly ones that were born and raised or lived for a long time outside of the United States, are deciding that the benefits don't outweigh the hassles of maintaining the U.S. citizenship, and that's why you are seeing increasing numbers, exponentially increasing numbers of Americans giving up citizenship.
I think that one of the fears that people have would be that if they give up their U.S. citizen, I'll actually ask you two questions. One is that they won't be able to go back and visit their family. And two, if they are receiving Social Security or they're going to receive a Social Security pension one day, that that may be turned off if they give up their citizenship. How does that work?
Well, once you give up your U.S. citizenship, you are then a foreigner. If we're going to continue with the example of an Israeli, Israel is not on the U.S. visa waiver list, so that person would need to get a U.S. visa. They would then come to the United States. And in the 25 years I've been doing expatriation, I've never had a client who's had a problem either getting a visa, if their passport they carry required one, or when they got the visa or if they didn't need the visa, getting entry at the port of entry. It's almost like Homeland Security is saying, come on in, and the IRS is saying, and we hope you stay too long, because significant presence or physical presence in the United States is another way of attracting U.S. tax status.
So let me just say that back to you. I want to be very clear. If the people you know, your experience has been people who give up their U.S. citizenship and mostly live outside the United States, but simply want to go back to the U.S., I guess, either for a vacation or for business, don't have a problem getting a visa?
Correct.
The U.S. doesn't secretly frown upon them and say, aha, commie, we'll keep them out?
Hasn't been my experience, and that's 25 years of experience. The cases that I see where people claim that they've had a problem, when you look at it a bit closer, you find that they had other issues or they were just poorly advised or did a poor submission. You are going to be like any foreigner, however. When you give up your U.S. citizenship, you have forgone the right to enter the United States. You are seeking the indulgence of the United States to allow you entry. But again, I, for example, have never had a U.S. citizenship. I've been there thousands of times, never had a problem. Again, my clients who present themselves properly have never had a problem.
So let's talk more about people who present themselves properly. Someone who's been paying his taxes all along, and maybe he's accumulated a few million dollars in savings and 401ks, and the house he bought outside of America 10, 15 years ago has now appreciated in value. So let's say he's worth several million dollars, and he no longer wants to be in the tax net, but he's on the up and up, so he's not a tax sneak. What are the tax consequences, both currently to give up the citizenship, as well as that he has to worry about going forward?
Well, giving up your U.S. citizenship has both an immigration and citizenship component, which we've been talking about, but it also has a tax component. At the time that if you want to use expatriation as a way of leaving the U.S. tax net, you also have to file a form with the IRS called the IRS 8854. And the 8854 asks you two questions. The first one is looking at the last 5 years and the check that you sent to the United States. It's not your income, it's your U.S. tax liability. Add all that up, divide by five, and for 2014, what was that amount over $157,000 U.S. that you paid in tax? Or on the date that you walk into the U.S. embassy and renounce your citizenship, did you have more than $2 million in worldwide income?
Income or assets?
I said income. It's wealth. Okay. In assets.
And that includes everything you own.
Worldwide. On the 8854, there are some things you can do with regards to related party transfers, et cetera, but it's all set up on the IRS 8854. And if you trigger either of those two tests, you are what is called a covered expatriate. And it is at that point that there are some tax ramifications upon expatriation. There is an ability to overcome being a covered expatriate if, for example, you had become an Israeli citizen at birth and you had become an American because your mother or your father had passed that on to you. But if, in our example, the person is a covered expatriate, then there are going to be two significant events that happen for them. First is that they are going to have a deemed disposition. They're going to have a capital gains event. They're going to have to pay tax on the capital gains that's appreciated on their assets. The second is that if they want to leave money in their estate to a U.S. person or a U.S. taxpayer, that is also going to be subject to tax. Now, that latter you can overcome with some proper planning. But it's the deemed disposition that most people are focusing on.
Got it. So the issue is, if you have accumulated some level of significant wealth, then when you expatriate, it is not just a question of no longer having a U.S. passport, but there really could be a tax consequence. David, this is actually very interesting, but we are just about out of time. We've been talking to David Lesperance, who's an expert in the international taxation and ramifications of expatriation. In the last few seconds, just tell us, how can people learn more about you and follow your work?
Well, they can go to the website for a book that I've just co-authored called Flight of the Golden Geese. And on that website, they can also see a link to my law firm's website.
Okay, and we will put a link to all of that at the show notes of today's show at goldsteinongelt.com. David Lesperance, thanks so much for your time.
Been a pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
Need personal financial tips, Wall Street jargon beyond your lips. Goldstein gives you wisdom for all of this. Goldstein on Gelt for investments.
If you decide to give up your U.S. citizenship, big radical move, I understand, but if you decide to do it, you don't have to worry about having a U.S. brokerage account. In our office, we deal with people who both are U.S. citizens and non-U.S. citizens, and they're allowed to have U.S. brokerage accounts. You have to know how to do it, and as a client, you should make sure you work with a company that has expertise in cross-border clients, but there's no problem with either U.S. or non-U.S. citizens having a U.S. brokerage account. There are problems sometimes, as if you're an American citizen, you know, if you have an Israeli bank account, let's say you live in Israel, and you want to do some investing there, these days they've become very unfriendly to Americans. So make sure you realize you're not stuck investing through your Israeli bank. It's not a problem at all to have a U.S. brokerage account as long as you find a company that can handle that. I spoke about that recently at the AACI in Jerusalem. We gave a speech there. But I've also got an article about this called How to Open a U.S. Brokerage Account When You Live Overseas, and that's available on the website of my core business, Profile Investments. In fact, what we'll do is we'll put a link to that article, which I think everyone should read because it includes the 10 steps that you need to know about opening a U.S. brokerage account if you are a non-resident, a non-U.S. resident. But it applies, again, to U.S. citizens and non-U.S. citizens. And we'll put a link to that at the show notes of today's show at goldsteinongelt.com. Stay tuned for part two. We'll be bringing on Lisa Adams to talk to us about some very interesting money ideas.
You're listening to Money Maven Doug Goldstein on the Goldstein on Gelt Show. Stay tuned for the second half of the show right after the break.